behind San Jose, California. Rick Silverman, who lives in Manhattan, says he sees a lot more cops in uniform out and about.
I feel a lot safer here.
Murders are down 9%. Car thefts are down 10%. But there's one area of bad news. Rapes are up more than 8%. That's double the national average.
I have three daughters, and it scares me all the time.
Robin Walensky, New York.
Catholic Bishop Thomas O'Brien of Phoenix is being questioned by police about a fatal hit-and-run accident. Police served a search warrant today on O'Brien's home. Authorities say there is damage to the front side of a car that O'Brien drives.
On the first hour of Issues Etc. this afternoon, Christian ethics in the workplace. AM 850 KFUO weather for St. Louis. Overnight, mostly clear, low of about 64. For Tuesday, going to be sunny and a high near 87. A nice afternoon on the way tomorrow. A carbon copy of this afternoon, maybe. We'll see tomorrow. Right now, mostly sunny and 84 in St. Louis.
Is there an AM 850 KFUO staff member that you would like to send email to, but you don't know the address? Well, it's simple to find it. Just go to KFUO.org and click near the upper right-hand corner the Contact KFUO button, and then you'll see a list of staff members and their email addresses. It's that simple. If you'd like to send one email to all of us, just send it to webmaster@KFUO.org.
If you enjoy Broadway musicals, don't miss the fourth annual Broadway for Life concert. Featuring top St. Louis performers singing music from Godspell, Camelot, Sound of Music, Miss Saigon, and South Pacific One Night Only. A wonderful evening for your family and friends. 8 o'clock Saturday, June 21st at Immaculata Church Auditorium, 8900 Clayton Road. Broadway for Life concert.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. You can find information about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month is Christian Ethics in the Workplace. The cost is $14.99. 1-800-325-3040.
In the first half hour of Issues Etc. today, we feature another of our co-authors from our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. I'll tell you about the book a little bit later. Ray Hilgert will join us via telephone for the first half hour of the program. We're going to talk about some practical guidelines for making better ethical decisions in the workplace. It's very good advice. He has a few tests, if you will, that we'll talk about a little later in the conversation. In the second half hour of the program, Sean Heady, a doctoral candidate at Ohio State University and author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone magazine titled Father's Day in Court, will recount for us a very interesting jury selection process on a paternity case that he contends tells us a lot about how we here in postmodern America view fatherhood. We'll talk about that in the second half hour of Issues Etc. In the second hour, Eric Pement of the Moody Bible Institute will join us to talk about Eric Rudolph and the Christian identity movement. Is it proper to call this a Christian movement, properly Christian? What about the term Christian terrorist or Christian extremist? We'll talk about all of that with Eric Pement in the second hour of the program. After that, we'll spend an hour talking with two individuals here in Studio A, one who's come out of the Campbellite movement and another who has family in the Campbellite movement, and we'll be talking about the Campbellite Church of Christ. And then, at 5:30 to round off our program, Dr. James Lamb, Executive Director of Lutherans for Life, will join us to talk about fatherhood and abortion. It's all guests for all 3 hours, no open lines, Monday here on Issues Etc. Our phone numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Raymond Hilgert is Professor Emeritus of Management and Industrial Relations at Washington University here in St. Louis. He's co-author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. Ray, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's great to be here again.
Let's begin by distinguishing between ethics and what is a very common term in the workplace, and that is compliance. What's the difference between those two?
Well, I think it's something that a lot of times people get confused about, namely that as long as something is legal or it complies with a law or a regulation or a policy, that somehow then it's ethical. Now, complying with the law is certainly something that should be a starting point. But ethics goes way beyond, in my judgment, just mere compliance. Under compliance, primarily people are looking at the letter of the law, doing what they have to do, and they're very much concerned with rules and conformance. But a person who is thinking ethically goes beyond the letter of the law and thinks about the spirit of the law. How do we do the right things? What should we be doing? And much more concerned about values and choices, and there's certainly this caring for people as a very major component of an ethical kind of a choice.
How do I know in the workplace that I'm in an ethical situation?
Well, just about everything in the workplace involves an ethical choice. A colleague of mine at Washington University developed a little model that sort of identifies a feature of an ethical moral situation. And essentially, it's an ethical choice, or at least a decision involves an ethical choice, if it involves the interests and values of others as well as my own, requires judgment, requires action, and certainly if what we decide is going to affect my person and the lives and persons of other people. And when you think about it in the workplace, just about everything that goes on where choices are made does affect other people and their interests.
How do we break this down into a kind of, well, and you know how business is. Business is often broken down into a series of decisions, a series of crossroads. How do we break this down into a decision-making process so that even if we're simply trying to comply with a model, we can be at least guided generally toward ethical decisions in the workplace?
Well, we have in the book, or at least in the chapter that I wrote, two essential ways of trying to approach it. The one is sort of a general decision-making model, which can be very helpful, especially if you've got something that involves sort of a long-term kind of a decision that's going to have, you know, major implications. The second is sort of a series of quick tests that can be very helpful. Do you want me to run through the first one here?
Well, I tell you what, why don't we do it this way with kind of the decision-making model? Let me give you a for instance.
Okay.
One actually drawn from the chapter of your book, and then you, if you would, take us through the step-by-step of how one would arrive at an ethical decision, because it's really about making, in this case, making a decision. In general terms, you tell the story of a young woman who works for a chemical operation, and she has discovered that her colleagues as well as her supervisors are misusing a fund that is set aside for miscellaneous laboratory expenses like lab coats, smocks, uniforms, things like that, and they're buying personal clothing for themselves with this account. Take us through establishing kind of the basic decision-making model.
All right, the first thing that she's got to do is to make sure she's got her facts straight. And that's one of the first things that we have in any decision-making model, is to make sure that the facts you have are accurate and what are the ones that are relevant. Oftentimes you get a host of things before you, but some may be relevant to your decision, some are not. And then I think the second thing you have to do then is to sort of identify as best you can what are the ethical issues? Now, in the case that you have here, obviously, there's some fraud, and maybe you could even call it stealing going on, and there's sort of a conspiracy in which they've reached that level of, well, others are doing it, why not me? So she's got to identify the ethical issues. The third step is to try to identify whose interests are involved, who's going to be the most affected by it. Well, certainly the company's interests are involved. The individuals who are doing it, their interests are affected by it, or can be if it becomes public knowledge. And then her own interests are involved. Should she even get involved in it in the sense that she wants to do something about it, or just be quiet about it, or and worse still, perhaps go into you know, sort of a feeling, well, they're doing it, why shouldn't I? And the next step then is probably the hardest part, is to develop a list of those kinds of alternatives that might help to solve the problem. And again, in your hypothetical situation there, she's got to decide, well, does she really want to try to do something about it? And some of her alternatives might be to confront the individuals, to talk to them about it, if that isn't satisfactory, to report it to somebody in higher management. Might have some other possibilities that might be there that could be helpful in solving it. And then she's got to analyze each of these as to what would be the impact. And then the choice we have in the book to select the solution that provides the optimum ethical resolution. It may well be in this situation that there is no real good solution. No matter what she decides, something is not going to be quite 100%. That's normal. That is, you know, the way life is. There's rarely that you have a solution that's going to be perfect. But what she should try to do is to pick the alternative that she thinks is going to give the best overall result in the immediate and as well as the long run, and then see what happens. So that's kind of the way you walk through a case of that nature.
So she's really just looking at this situation, making sure that she's seeing it accurately, trying to figure out who is involved in this and who will be affected. She's laying out her alternatives. She determines, or tries to the best of her ability to determine which one leads to the most ethical result, and then she has to have the courage to do that in the workplace.
Yeah, and it does require courage in many situations, especially if the people involved are her colleagues.
Now, let's talk about this series of tests. In fact, in a previous conversation with Jim Truesdell, another of the co-authors of this book, he actually made reference to this a little bit, but there wasn't a lot of explanation. You lay out a series of five tests, and I want you to explain each one of them to us, if you could. The first one you call the legal/compliance test. What's that test?
Well, basically, again, these are sort of quick tests that you can apply in situations where you have a question about the ethical nature of the decision. The legal compliance test says, check it out. Make sure, first of all, that what you're dealing with or what you're contemplating is lawful, or if you're in a company, whether there's a policy or procedure in place. So many times people, they just assume that since somebody's doing something, or quite a few people are doing something, that it's okay. Well, maybe it isn't okay. And so the very first thing that you need to do is to ascertain whether something is proper, get help from a higher manager, the legal office, human resources department, to make sure you're on firm ground.
The next test that you lay out for us is the public knowledge test. What is that?
Well, I think that's one of the best tests of all, in my judgment. It says that whenever you're thinking about making a choice, ask yourself, what would happen if the decision that I would make or am I contemplating making would become known to the public. And the public can be almost anybody. It can be higher management. It can be somebody in the news media. It can be someone you love. Would you be comfortable with explaining your decision to a spouse, a child, somebody that is very, very close to you? And if something says to you, I don't think I'd be very comfortable with this, there's probably some ethical concerns here that ought to be jumping out at you. You know, one of the signals that I've always used in this is if you're in a meeting and somebody says, okay, we don't want to let this get out. This is something that we want to all keep under our hats. Well, that's a place where the ethical bells ought to go off. Now, I know that there are situations where confidentiality is needed. But if it's a situation where people are trying to keep something under wraps, undercover, almost always the public knowledge test says, hey, there's something that's not quite right with that choice.
The long-term consequences test.
Yes, well, that's one, again, that I think so often people get caught up in the here and now, the quick sale, the quick profit. If I do this, I'll get my bonus. And they don't look down the road. Hey, what will this do as far as the long-term position of the firm, the trust that will be made or lost with a customer? You know, building trust is something that has to be done with a consistency and an action that is not full of all kinds of ups and downs and deviance. And so the question is, what is going to be the best decision that's going to do the most good for most of us over a longer period of time?
You know, it seems that second and third test are somewhat interrelated, especially in the practical world where ethical decisions sometimes, first of all, the public knowledge test is failed. They say, well, we wouldn't want the public to know this, and so they do actively cover up what they're doing in a firm or a business. And then they fail to ask what happens when it does eventually, as it always does, what happens when it does eventually become public knowledge, and some of these guys go off to jail, the CEOs, wondering, you know, how did I ever get to this point? Because they didn't ask those two questions.
That's exactly right, and it really is sad, you know, and these are supposedly intelligent people, too.
All right, another test that you lay before us is the examine your motives test.
Now, this requires a person to really have an introspective view of himself or herself, and I would like to think that Christians are particularly or should be particularly adept at this. To look inside yourself and say, hey, now what really am I most interested in here? What really are my priorities? Am I really trying to make a decision that's going to benefit the firm, not harm other people, do something that will be perceived by others as being fair and equitable? Or am I just trying to do something that's going to be primarily for my own self-interest? And I think a Christian ought to be able to work their way through that one.
So while we would recognize as Christians that our motives are never 100% pure, there is always the taint of sin on our motives. We never act from a pure heart. We ought to at least ask ourselves the question, am I overtly acting from an ulterior motive with regard to this decision?
Yeah, I would think so.
The inner voice or the conscience test. Tell us about that one.
Well, that should be the first one. I don't know. I've got that in the list as the last one. But it's sort of like the cleanup hitter because it really is the test that, again, as Christians should be, uppermost in our mind. It's that voice that's been implanted in us from, well, almost day one, you know, the teachings from our parents, our teachers, our pastors, and then all the kinds of things that are programmed into us by the educational systems, our experiences, our work experiences. And over time, we have sort of a roadmap. And I think where it's most helpful is that when you have a decision and you're thinking about it, and something inside you will say to you, hey, Ray, you know, this choice doesn't seem quite right. There's something not right with it. Or, hey, Ray, this really isn't a good decision. That inner voice, you call it your conscience, call it the voice of God within us, almost always is giving us the signal that says, look for a better alternative. Don't stick with this one. There's something wrong with it. And if you follow that inner voice, most of the time, it's going to give you very good advice.
We are talking about, you know, the conscience informed by the clear word of God in the case of a Christian, aren't we?
Yes.
Now, you said that one might be better put first, and I imagine that is the one that probably in most real-life business ethical, unethical situations gets left off altogether.
Todd, I'm having trouble hearing you. Could you try that again? I just couldn't hear you there.
Sure. You said that the conscience test ought to be the first one that Christians probably look at, but it seems to me that in most business situations that involve ethics, especially when the wrong decision is made, this is the conscience test is the one that they never try. They never even consult the conscience.
Well, I guess that's because of the pressures of business and the priorities that are there. Well, all of these, there's a certain amount of overlap in them. But, you know, as Christians, that conscience ought to be uppermost in just about everything that we do. It's sort of the way we are to behave in everything. We are to be carrying our badge of Christianity, not just in what we say, but by what we do. And so I think that the voice of that conscience within us is a terrific guideline.
If you look at all of these as interrelated tests, if you run them backwards, you can see how the newspaper headlines can be filled with stories of corporate scandal when someone fails to listen to the basic conscience. They often will then also fail to examine their motives, to consider the long-term consequences, to consider what would happen if this became public knowledge, and then in the end, they're really not all that concerned about whether it's even legal anymore.
Yeah, it really is sad that some of these individuals nominally were religious people, but they just got themselves totally mixed up and forgot all of the ethical components of what they were doing, and of course they wind up disgraced, and a number of them are going to wind up in jail.
How, as you have taught people, young people going through business school, how much of a factor, how much of a concern of those who are entering the business world are ethics?
Well, it's hard to generalize on that, but I would say that from my gathering is most of the students are not all that ethically concerned. They are taught to be bottom line focused, and ethics seems to be sort of a tack on, oh yeah, we are supposed to behave ethically, but it really doesn't get the emphasis I think that it ought to get. And so when they go into an organization, and if the organization is primarily bottom line focused, well then that kind of reinforces that attitude, and it's no wonder we have so many problems with this in business.
Do you think more businesses need not only a legal department to say, yeah, this is legal, here are our policies, here are our rules, but perhaps even someone whose job is to be the go-to person on ethical questions? When someone down the line has an ethical question, he can go in and confidentially inquire of someone there who will keep the confidentiality, let him know it's legal, let him know what the policy is, and help him sort through the ethical dilemma?
Well, I think that's a terrific idea, and a number of companies, of course, have done that, where they have somebody who is identified. Typically, the term is an ombudsman, or they may have what's called an ethics committee, and where a person sees something or observes something that he or she has questions about, they can report it or raise an inquiry and do it on an anonymous basis, and then the ombudsman or somebody from the ethics committee looks into it and makes a judgment, and that's a very big help. Now, that's a pretty good idea for big companies. Small companies, oftentimes, the president of the company or the top executive officer supposedly serves in that role, but if the president of the company is himself not an ethical person, then the individual doesn't have really much place that he or she can go when faced with the situation of that nature.
Ray, would you stay with us for just a few minutes after this break?
Sure.
Raymond Hilgert is our guest. He's co-author of Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June, titled Christian Ethics in the Workplace. We're talking about some practical guidelines for making better ethical decisions in the workplace. Our phone numbers, 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, a few more minutes with Ray Hilgert, and then we'll spend the rest of the hour talking with Sean Hetty. He's author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled Father's Day in Court. We'll talk about a particular situation he found himself in, a jury selection for a paternity suit that taught him a lot about how we view fatherhood in postmodern America. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Perhaps you've heard someone say, right and wrong are all fine and good, but this is business. Is the place of business any place for Christian ethics? How does the Christian square the profit motive, the bottom line, and business competition with Christian ethics? In Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, its authors explore these very questions and, through case studies, show how Christian ethics work in the workplace. You can receive your copy by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. The book costs $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Or order online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book. When you call or write, be sure to ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on a church in Thailand where kids have a strong vision for the future. They're members of the Shan Ethnic Group. There's an orphanage in Thailand which also serves as a church for a number of children. Harry LaHaye, the Christian broadcaster and musician from Michigan, traveled with a team to serve with Shan Christians. LaHaye says the kids are being raised as Christian leaders for the future.
The church is made up of the Shan orphans and also some of the staff at the orphanage, most of whom are Shan, and also some people from the surrounding area. There's maybe 75 people in this church.
LaHaye was able to write worship songs in the Shan language. They're considered an unreached people group. About 5 million Shan live in several Asian countries, and about 10,000 of them are Christians. Pray for this Shan church to demonstrate Christ's love to Buddhists around them. Pray for unreached people by logging on to the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. John Teffler of the Midland, Michigan Daily News wrote that he recently told a young woman, "When I was young, we used to communicate by writing letters to one another. My wife and I wrote love letters more often than we talked on the phone." To that, the young woman replied, "I've received an instant message love letter." Someplace my wife has hidden a bundle of love letters I wrote to her when we were dating. Now and then she pulls them out, and wow, was I a boring letter writer. But I did write. Not type, not instant message, and she wrote back. "Once I hand-wrote a letter to a donor to our ministry. He later thanked me, but he added, 'I know you didn't write that yourself, but it was nice.' Harold, I said, it wasn't computer generated. I wrote that letter myself. Maybe a few more handwritten letters would break through the cynicism of our times. And an instant message love letter? Those love letters Diane and I wrote turned into a marriage 30 years ago today. Happy anniversary, Diane.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton, asking you to become a day sponsor on AM 850 KFUO. I think it's one of the most rewarding ways to support this ministry on the radio and on the web. You pick a day and theme, we record the announcements. And what's really cool is the good example you set. Have you ever considered how being a day sponsor voices your active support and actually encourages others to generously fund AM 850 KFUO? Call me to learn more about becoming a day sponsor on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., but one word with Dr. Jeff Gibbs of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. The word is hope. And we'll talk about that one word with Dr. Jeff Gibbs tomorrow. Also, part two of our 10-part series on the historic liturgy with Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. Well, this is something that we've got a fair amount of positive response to, and we had a great beginning this last week with Pastor Whedon. We'll start into the actual particulars of the liturgy in part two of this 10-part series that'll run through the summer on Issues Etc. Raymond Hilgert is our guest for the next few minutes. We're going to conclude our conversation with him. Just one or two questions. Some practical guidelines for making better ethical decisions in the workplace is the topic. He's one of the co-authors of our Issues Etc. book of the month for June, titled Christian Ethics in the Workplace. Ray, you say that following these tests, the legal tests, the examine your motive tests, the public knowledge test, the long-term consequences test, even the conscience test, will not always be sufficient for arriving at genuinely ethical decisions. Why do you say that?
Well, it's not a perfect world. And no matter what you do, and even the most concerned person, going to find sometimes the choices are limited by maybe the job situation, the time factor, unfortunate consequences, maybe layoffs or somebody's having their position downgraded and so forth, things that are going to happen that will be maybe hurtful to somebody, so that no matter how hard you try, you're going to have some situations where there is not going to be a solution that's going to be totally satisfactory. But I think, again, if you're a Christian, you apply these tests, at least you can take comfort in the knowledge that you have tried as a Christian to put all of your conscience and your knowledge and your abilities to analyze these sort of problems, to put them to the test, and you've tried to come up with the best decision under the circumstances. And that I think, is what we as Christians have got to try to do.
Finally, the workplace is, for the Christian, sometimes viewed as a minefield of daily making decisions where it seems like compromise is almost called for, encouraged in some cases, especially by, if not policies, by the unwritten policies of the place they work. What is your best advice to the Christian in the workplace who finds himself almost daily challenged in his ethics?
Well, again, I think that the Christian has to recognize that his first obligation ultimately is to his Savior and the teachings of Christ, and that should be the overall concern. Now, you don't have to wear your religion on a sleeve, but you can show that by your decisions and by what you're doing, that you do take your faith, your ethical kinds of considerations very, very seriously, and you're not going to be drawn into making choices that are not sound, that are the kinds of decisions that cause harm to others and so forth, and you're going to do everything you can to try to win other people over to more ethical kinds of considerations in what they do. And you're not going to win every issue or battle or confrontation, but I think over time people will learn to respect you, and that it does have a way of rubbing off if you continue to show that your ethical choices and are based upon your faith, and people then recognize that you're a person who has high standards and you're going to put them into practice.
Let's get a listener's question in here before our time runs out. Ruthie is calling from her car. Ruthie, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for your program. I was wondering what your thoughts are on Christians in the payday loan business. On the one hand, the interest is quite high, I mean upwards of, I think, 70% over a year. But on the other hand, this is the only place some of these people can go to get loans. They can't go into a bank because they don't have good credit. I just want your thoughts on that.
Thank you, Ruthie. It's a good question. Ray?
Well, I think honesty here is probably the most important thing. You know, when people come in, and often in these situations, they're very desperate to get help, and they sign up without the knowledge of exactly what they're signing on to, I think that's where an ethical flag has to be raised. I think it's very incumbent that the individual is totally informed as to, if he or she negotiates the loan, exactly what the costs are going to be and some of the consequences for failure to meet payments. And then if the individual still insists that this is what he or she wants to do, I think then they have fulfilled their obligation to the customer.
Raymond Hilgert, thank you very much for being our guest.
It's my pleasure, Todd.
Raymond Hilgert is Professor Emeritus of Management and Industrial Relations at Washington University here in St. Louis. He's co-author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, titled Christian Ethics in the Workplace. It really is about, he mentioned honesty there at the end. Even a situation like that, if it is honestly dealt with, can be one that is above board, where people are not being taken advantage of, but the temptation is always there. That's why we're recommending this book, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. You can purchase the book by calling Concordia Publishing House in the next hour and 20 minutes at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The cost of the book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Order Christian Ethics in the Workplace also online at your leisure at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the book, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, 1-800-325-3040, or our website, issuesetc.org. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking with Shane Heady. He's a doctoral candidate at Ohio State University, author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled Father's Day in Court. Shane, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Shane, tell us the story of the jury selection process in this paternity suit that appears to have taught you quite a bit about how postmodern America views fatherhood.
It was just bizarre circumstance that I happened to be drafted to serve in a jury, or at least in the jury pool, for a paternity suit on Father's Day itself. I had wondered how strange Father's Day was going to begin with, when I had difficulty finding a Father's Day card that was two fathers from a distance, since I live at some distance from my family, because the card was surrounded by Father's Day cards for mother, uncle, teacher, and neighbor, and which suggested to me how fatherhood is starting to, the idea of fatherhood is starting to break down in our culture. And this was echoed in the jury selection process. As I saw at each stage of the jury selection process, throughout one series of certainties by which we could know what a father is or what anything real was, and that put together each of these three stages really sort of forced subscription to a postmodern mindset for anybody who would serve on that jury.
Let's walk through this. You liken the jury selection process that you witnessed in this paternity suit, so fatherhood really was at stake.
Quite literally, yes.
You liken it to kind of a poor man's Survivor episode in which a pool of candidates are one by one eliminated because they can't pass certain skill challenges. The first skill challenge, if you will, that you say was laid before the pool of potential jurors in this paternity case was that of mental flexibility. What do you mean by that?
Yes. Mental flexibility means an abandonment of any kind of traditional concept of logic, in favor of a lack of absolutes or ideas that there's any set way of determining truth. The lawyer for the defendant came up in screening the candidates and said, many people assume that if you cause a child to be born, it's yours forever. You own it. You're a parent. But nothing's that simple. You know, legally, ownership or parenthood can be temporary. If you leave a suit at the laundromat for a week, it's still yours. But if you leave it there for a year or 2 years, can you still be angry if the laundromat sold it? Well, then at some point, the laundry at the laundromat ceases to be yours. So ownership and parenthood aren't so simple, after all, are they? She said. Now, obviously, this is logically a form of argument by analogy. Children aren't meaningfully analogous to laundry. You know, laundry is for use, and children have inherent value. In order to accept this test, you have to be mentally flexible enough to accept a bad analogy. And one devoted mother got thrown off the jury for rejecting that standard, for not being sufficiently mentally flexible.
So in other words, the defense attorney here was asking the potential jurors to liken a father begetting a child to someone simply forgetting their suit at the laundromat, and if he's been absent long enough, the child really isn't his anymore. Something along those lines?
Exactly. Quite precisely. And what was disturbing of this process is that it was cumulative. Everybody who passed on to the second skill challenge had to already accept that. You know, they had to already have passed the first one.
So the second skill challenge that you say was laid before this pool of potential jurors in the paternity case was the test of deconstructive and linguistic prowess. What do you mean by that?
Well, as an English major, this is something I'm quite accustomed to. Deconstructive and linguistic prowess, as I referred to it, was the idea that words don't have inherent meaning. A common enough idea now that if you say that something has a set definition, particularly anything human, like fatherhood or right or wrong, then that's repressive because you're rejecting some definitions and favoring others, whereas somebody else might feel differently. For that challenge, the lawyer said, simply causing a child to be born doesn't make you a father. It takes more than that to make a father. A father is the person that you bond with more than anybody on earth. An uncle may really be the father in your life or a sister in the neighbor. If your sperm donor hasn't bonded with you, then he can't be your father. It's deconstructive in that it breaks the meaning of the word down. It takes the primary meaning of father, male biological parent, and splits it against the secondary meaning, which would be central caregiver. And with the result of having no certainty about what a father really is.
So in the first case, the defense attorney is asking the potential jurors to accept a false analogy between begetting a child and forgetting a suit at the laundromat.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second case, the defense attorney is asking the potential jurors, those who have accepted the first one there, that first analogy, to say, look, not only does childhood really not mean anything more than property, fatherhood means really nothing more than who you're closest to.
Yeah, sort of like the kind of a legal definition of a family as just being a group of people living under one roof that some groups are pushing for currently. So while the first test threw out logic, the second one essentially throws out empiricism and throws out science. And in fact, one of the people who was thrown off the jury for not passing that test was a chemist, because you know, chemically she was quite aware that a sperm donor is a father.
And really, I mean, if you think about it, what could be at stake in a paternity case except the simple fact of who is the biological father of this child?
Yeah, that was partly what baffled me. I kind of regretted that I wasn't able, that I was eventually struck from the pool myself and wasn't able to stay around to see what the final outcome of this was.
Well, the third and final challenge that was laid before this potential pool, this pool of potential jurors in the paternity case, was what you call the test of the limits of our sympathy. How was that put before the panel?
The defense attorney said to us that, you know, we're going to be talking about some pretty uncomfortable topics in this case, some pretty explicit topics. I'm not saying for certain, but it's likely that the child was conceived as a product of an adulterous affair. So if talking about adultery makes you uncomfortable, or if you think adultery is always and only wrong, or that adulterers are bad people, perhaps it's best that you don't serve on this jury, because we all do different things under different circumstances and different pressures, and you know we can't really judge what anybody should do under any given situation. So this asks us to subscribe to a really kind of radical form of moral relativism, where anybody who would have held there as being an absolute in this case was struck off the jury. And the main thing that was difficult about it, of course, was that you were being asked to sympathize with somebody who we didn't see had been wronged or any of the other kind of ways that relativism usually causes sympathy.
Again, it seems that what would be at stake here in a paternity case would be who is actually the father of the child, and it sounds as though the attorney there was arguing, well, the circumstances under which the child was conceived can basically lead to conclude that even though, yes, the child was conceived by this man, the man still isn't the child's father because of maybe it was just a one-night stand, maybe it was just hooking up, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, abundantly. What horrified me about the whole process, one of the reasons I wrote the article, was that each of the series of tests threw out a way that people come to know reality or to establish certainty. One way people have historically done that is through abstract logic, and by having to accept a false analogy, that was thrown out in the first test. Another way that people have tried to do that is through empirical science, and that was thrown out with the second test. And then with the third test, where all morals and ethics have to be relative, then you know, another set of standards gets thrown out. And the cumulative effect of this is to be in a kind of nihilistic situation where nothing has meaning and we can't be sure of anything.
The thing that I found most astonishing in your account is that of the dozen or so that were originally in the pool, there were six jurors who actually could stomach these four tests and be selected for the jury. One of them, you point out, was a minister.
Yeah, and another was a marriage counselor. So, yeah, I found it really, really kind of troubling that, that those two people would pass the qualifiers.
Now, what does this tell you about the popular notion of fatherhood, or perhaps better put, how easily we are led in our postmodern society to an entirely different definition of fatherhood, which may well be the popular definition?
It seemed very much like people were so uncomfortable as far as putting forth any kind of claim to truth that they could very easily be led to deny things that they might kind of naturally consider true or personally consider true. Any kind of idea of a collective truth is so under fire in a postmodern society that people could be led into the idea of fatherhood itself as a social construct, as fatherhood as something that isn't inherent ethically or spiritually or even biologically, but that we've just kind of agreed upon for the moment by mutual consensus and that we might change tomorrow.
Is the concept of fatherhood under any particular attack, do you think, or is it just yet another of many casualties to this postmodern way of thinking in our culture?
Well, I think it's probably under particular attack since kind of a radical variants of feminism have been especially behind the sort of postmodern or post-structuralist attack on meaning, on essences. But I think it is an instance of a general phenomena. But since, fathers are tied to birth and to origins, and a postmodern assault on meaning usually ends up going back to an assault on the idea of things as having one set origin or essence. It all ends up going back to Genesis. I think fatherhood is particularly under attack, too.
I just wonder about the child who was in part the subject of this paternity suit, or at least a party to it. What eventually this child is going to be told by mother, father, whoever it may be, about who their father is.
Yeah, I was baffled about that myself. Whatever the suit decides, what can you say? That the court eventually forced an acknowledgement of fatherhood, which seems unlikely given the pool that they selected, or that that while biologically he's known, legally he's not. It's very strange the way it split things like that. But the one thing I was sure of by the end of the experience was that however confused he might be about who his father was, he'd have no shortage of greeting cards to address his situation.
That's for sure. Father in quotations might not be a bad one.
Yeah.
Quote unquote Father's Day. Postmodernism began as a formal linguistic theory put forth by linguists. That's mm-hmm. your area of expertise. Give us some insight into how something that began as something rather arcane and academic has spread out to become the very atmosphere we breathe in American culture.
Well, it does start among linguists, this kind of an arcane theory that all meaning is created within a specific linguistic field of reference. So it's that all ideas tend to be culturally specific because the language that we use to express them is the language of a particular people or a particular culture. And that later gets combined with the idea that the meaning of words is kind of inherently uncertain because words get their meanings through a series of oppositions and can shift depending on context. That ends up bleeding out into culture in a number of different ways, partly because, obviously everything that we ever say is made up of language. If you undermine the foundations of meaning in language, then it's going to bleed out into everything else. Historians studying texts are going to find, historians come to their understanding of history through analyzing texts, and those analyses are going to become less certain. Also, I think there's kind of a general cultural appeal because it was part of a general cultural movement away from meaning, especially with dissatisfaction with science. All hopes of meaning have been pushed on science. Then, especially after the atom bomb, with a distrust of science comes a kind of a general uncertainty about meaning. And then there was already this theory that undermined meaning that kind of came into the gap.
I wonder what can survive if postmodernism has its way. You call it a move away from meaning. Can history, as you mentioned, survive? Can theology, law, science, philosophy, for that matter, any human discourse that involves language survive if postmodernism is consistently applied?
No, I don't think it can. And the hopeful thing about that is that postmodernism can consistently survive if its theory were consistently applied to itself. If you really accept a radical, as many people have pointed out, C.S. Lewis among them, if you really accept a radical relativism where everything is relative either to the individual or to a culture and nothing is absolutely true, then that would be true about your relativism also. I'm not sure where this is going to all go eventually, but it seems like the theory would have to collapse on itself eventually, but how much societal damage may be done by then, I don't know.
Shane Heady, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
Shane Heady is a doctoral candidate at Ohio State University, and he's author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone magazine titled Father's Day in Court. Now here's something that if you worry about it at night as you go to sleep in this postmodern world, might give you a small bit of comfort as postmodernism seems to still be holding sway, not only in history and theology and law and science and philosophy, but in almost all human discourse. You can find someone on any street corner who will tell you, well, what's true for you isn't true for me, but we both have equally valid truths. And have a nice day, whatever that means. This might give you a little bit of comfort. The minute the postmodernist opens his mouth to speak, he acts against his own philosophy. The minute he uses a word, he acts against his own philosophy. Because if words have no meaning, if there is no such thing as objective meaning, he is simply making sounds, period. The minute he puts his pen to paper to try to express his thoughts, his ideas, his theories, his philosophy, or even to write the sentence, "There is no truth," he acts against his own theory. And it all comes crashing down, whether or not he knows it. And those are just scratches on a piece of paper, no different than if I handed the pen to a chimp or to any other animal. Put the pen in my dog's mouth, make some scratches on the paper. It all means just as much, which is nothing. You see, in the end, the postmodernist is trapped in a theory of his own making. He can't actually say anything about what he believes, because nothing can be true if it's only true for him. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Eric Pament, a Christian apologist with the Moody Bible Institute. He's education web designer there at Moody Bible Institute, about Eric Rudolph and the Christian identity movement. How does someone who goes, at least ostensibly, by the name Christian, bomb gay nightclubs or an Olympic event? We'll find out about Christian identity when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.
Come along for a spectacular ride through history and nature on our Southern Charms and Colors of Fall tour. This is Joni Harwell.
And I'm Diane Summers. We're so excited about this trip, November 1st through the 8th. Please join us.
Our journey takes us east through the rolling hills of Kentucky to our first overnight stop, Charleston, West Virginia. Of course, along the way, we'll pause to explore local handicrafts and curios.
Our senses will come alive with the brilliant colors of autumn, fiery red, deep purple and burnt orange. It's going to be beautiful.
Our stops include historic Williamsburg, Virginia, and Thomas Jefferson's Monticello.
We'll be gone with the wind in Charleston, South Carolina, visiting mansions and plantations. We'll stay in Nashville, Tennessee at the Opryland Hotel for our last night together before returning home.
Doesn't this sound great? Call us now for more information at 314-505-7800 or toll free at 1-800-844-0524.
Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers, for Living Jubilee, 1105 Monday through Friday on AM 850 KFUO, Clayton, St. Louis.
AP Network News, I'm Lisa Meyer. A dozen blacks who were put in jail in a series of drug busts in Texas are now free. A judge released them today, pending appeals. They had been sent to prison based on the testimony of a single undercover agent who has now been discredited and who has now been charged with perjury. NAACP